Okay, it's 9:04. We have the.
Is the pastor here? Is he here? Is he here? We don't have him?
Well, that's all right. Too late now. We get what was the pastor? Mr. Cadane? Mr. Cadane, you know, she's not here. So, Mr. Cadane, we're going to have Mr. Cadane lead us in prayer. Thank you. Yeah. Please rise.
Lee said he'd give us a prayer in Hebrew.
We can go. We can have a culture, Lee.
Okay, let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this glorious day. Lord, thank you for being with us here at City Hall. Guide us, direct us, lead us in your will. Lord, let us make the right decisions, the ones that will glorify you in all we do. Thank you for all our many blessings. Keep us all safe from harm and evil. Bless this day. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Are you ready, Billy Ray? For the open mic speakers.
Good morning. Your speakers will begin with Chantel Arashvan, Cooper Caraway, Eric Coffrey, Darren Reed, and Oaklawn Green. I'll now recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any person making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks, or who becomes boisterous while addressing the City Council, shall be removed from the room. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the timer on the wall. When your time is up, please address your comments to Mayor Atkins. Your first speaker, Chantel S. Rossbron.
Good morning. I'm Chantal Rashband. I live in the 10th District. I'm not here today to talk about removing fluoride from the Dallas water. I'm here today to continue the discussion we started a few months ago, the discussion to encourage at least 9 of you to vote to halt the addition of fluoride to the Dallas water. The points I will discuss here today are all positive ones. First, Dallas will be out of the drug dispensing business. The fluoridation process was created to prevent tooth decay, not treat the water and make it safer. Fluoridation is a form of mass medication done without consent. The ethical concerns that are attached to medicating without consent would be over. The controversies surrounding the dosing issues would no longer be Dallas's concern or responsibility. And the money being spent on this could be redirected to other financially lacking areas. The people that believe ingesting fluoride prevents tooth decay need not be concerned because Dallas has fluoride in the raw, untreated water. And fluoride will still come freely through the tap even after additions are halted. Ken Del Regno, assistant director at the Dallas Water Department, stated on May 27th during the Quality of Life and Environment Committee meeting, quote, "There is already natural fluoride in the water, about 0.5 parts per million, which is just shy of the recommended goal of 7 parts per million," unquote. I gave you all a copy of a letter we received from a guy named Robert. This letter was a reply Robert received after he went to the water authorities in Hong Kong, where he lives. Water fluoridation was implemented in Hong Kong in 1961, and there had been several changes in the fluoride concentration, being 0.8 parts per million in 1961 through 1967, one part per million in 1967 through 1978, and 0.7 parts per million in 1978 through 1988. Then in 1988, they lowered the concentration to 0.5 parts per million and continued this concentration until now. 0.5 parts per million is the same level found in our raw water that's untreated. Actually, the raw water, actually, the raw fluoride level in Dallas often exceeds the Dallas target level of 0.7 parts per million. You were elected to look out for Dallas. There's no downside to doing this. No one is deprived fluoride. Hong Kong, with 7 million people, lowered their concentration to 0.5 parts per million. Fluoride is found in our daily lives, much more now than in 1965 when the city council voted the addition to the Dallas water. Be wise, stewards. The hydrofluoric acid we buy from Mosaic through Penico and add to the water to increase the fluoride levels have a disclaimer. They bear no responsibility. Dallas has enough to deal with. Vote to halt this now. And that's it. Thank you.
Your next speaker, Cooper Caraway. Mr. Caraway will be followed by Eric Coffrey, Darren Reed, and Oaklawn Green.
Good morning. My name's Cooper Caraway. I've been active in the community of Dallas here for a number of years. I worked for environmental organizations and labor organizations. In fact, I was the one who first created the City of Dallas's new labor task force that Judge Clay Jenkins, City Manager A.C. Gonzalez, and the head of the Central Labor Council sit on. I'm here today on behalf of Dallas Communities Organized for Change to talk about a piece of legislation that you were all sent regarding amending the Citizens Review Board, changing it and adding a little bit more teeth to it and making it a little more approachable to the everyday community. The legislation we sent to all of you is called the Office of the Police Monitor. What it would do is take the Citizens Review Board and make it a democratically elected board. What this does is it removes several layers of bureaucracy between the police department and the communities in Dallas. Everyone knows that, you know, recently we've had, in the past 10 years, we've had over 68 unarmed men shot by Dallas Police Department. Now, I understand that there's a vicious cycle that you all are working on, right? The community says we want you to decrease the crime rate, so you tell the police to send more troops in to the communities, and then when you send more people in, there are more arrests, and when there are more arrests, the crime rate goes up. It's a vicious circle. We think that all of this would be better suited to be handled by the community, rather than the community having to go to the police department itself, handle with internal affairs, which sometimes doesn't do its job as well as it should. We think it would be better if everything was handled by the community directly. Let it be democratically organized. Let them have some subpoena power and run parallel investigations along with the internal affairs. Right. So usually, you know, when people are having problems, when cities are having problems, the best thing to do is to democratize the situation the best way you can. Now, you know, we have this legislation. The legislation is written. It's been sent to all of you. And we could, you know, go to South Dallas, go to Oak Cliff, go to Pleasant Grove. And in a few Sundays, we'd have enough signatures to put this on the ballot in November or in the next election cycle, right? We could do that, and we will if things don't go our way. But we don't want to do that right now, you know, because if we do that, a community-based campaign, what it would do, it would help the community here, but it would not help the City of Dallas's reputation across the nation. Now, if the City Council decided to act, if the City Council decided to adopt this legislation or meet with us and negotiate or go ahead and put it on the ballot as a yes or no proposition, then the City of Dallas would enjoy a good reputation across the nation. The same way the Seattle City Council is now enjoying a good reputation by pushing forward $15 an hour minimum wage. Right? And so if the City of Dallas, if you all City Council decided to take this legislation on and push it forward to the voters of the City of Dallas, then Dallas could really be seen as leading the way in police accountability and government transparency. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Caraway?
Yeah. Cooper?
Mr. Hey, Cooper?
Cooper? Come back up a little bit. And I'm not responding just because your last name is Caraway, but I wanted to say. Listen, I want to say to all of you, as you continue to take your position, the way that you've just explained it, that is the way to begin to get our ears. So I would suggest and ask that you all continue I'm impressed to the fact that you all are coming down and you are signed up and you are speaking, and we're not raising sand. We know the capabilities of it, but at least giving us the opportunity to hear and giving us the chance to meet and to talk about it. Whether we at the end of the day agree but or disagree, at least it begins to bring up the dialogue. So I just want to commend you and say thanks for that, okay?
Right. We're all open to meeting with any of you in the future.
Okay. Thank
you. Thank you very much.
Next speaker, Eric Coffrey.
Good morning. We want immediate end to police brutality and murder of the people. Mr. Caraway here just spoke, and he spoke very candidly about an issue that's going on in our community. Mr. Caraway, City Council, we know that you all are very well aware. We put forth an ordinance that we call the Officer of the Police Monitor. What we feel is that it will hold rogue policemen in our community accountable. Let's go over some statistics. According to open records requests, over 68 unarmed men have been shot by Dallas Police Department. Only two just recently, because we believe because of the pressure that the community has been putting on the district attorney, has been indicted. Let's make it clear. It is very clear that there's an effort within the district attorney's office, within internal affairs, not to indict officers. The last officer that was indicted was in 1973, and that was Officer Daryl Kane for the murder of Santos Rodriguez. Of course, you all should be aware about that. So there's a lot of issues that we discuss in the community. We have some people here discussing water fluoridation. We have some people that's discussing various other important issues that's going on in the community. What we're saying loud and proud is that police brutality, what we say really is a euphemism, we say police terrorism, because anytime that the police can come to our community and systematically murder us, and it's clear, and the internal affairs investigate, nothing happens. It goes to the grand jury, nothing happens, and we have no bills. It's been over 68. This has been something that nobody wants to talk about. And realistically, councilmen, councilwomen, this has reached genocidal proportions. So we need you guys to actually do your jobs. Support the Officer of the Police Monitor. Put it before the people. We come here to you first, because they say this is part of the process. We come to you first to see what you guys are going to do about it. Because, as Mr. Caraway said, we have no bones, we make no bones, no issues about it taken directly to the people. So again, and I leave you with these words, we want immediate end to police brutality and the murder of the people, and we want the support of the City Council to do something about this issue, because like I said, we have no problem in going in the community, and we're going to continue to do that. Thank you.
Darren Reed. Mr. Reed will be followed by Oakland Green. Please state your name and address for the record.
Darren Reed, 3045 North Buckner. I want to start out with an analogy that Mark Cuban made. Mark Cuban said that when he sees a black man in a hoodie, that he will cross the street. That analogy is a direct attack on Trayvon Martin, because he is the most famous black man in a hoodie that you know of. And Trayvon Martin was murdered by George Zimmerman. This is just an example of how white people profile black people. Mark Cuban went on to say that if he went on the other side of the street and he saw a skinhead with a lot of tattoos, that he would cross the street again. He might have a reason to cross the street on that purpose. Okay? But putting Trayvon in that puzzle, we rebuke that. Because we know white guys commit crimes in hoodies too. The Boston City Bombers had on hoodies. Timothy McVeigh had on a hoodie. For us in the black community, when we see a Dallas police officer with a blue uniform, a badge, and a gun, that's when we want to cross the street. We have to teach our kids that when they make contact with a police officer, that they got to take their hands out their pocket. They got to pull their hoodie off. Why do they have to change their way of thinking because they come in contact with a police officer? Dallas Police Department has been known to hire racist, white supremacist police officers. The grandsons and the great-grandsons of Klan members. And on top of that, they're taking tactical training from private security companies. Calibre Press. Come into town. It don't have to be directed by the police department. These are private security companies that's teaching these police officers how to be more aggressive towards black kids in the black community. Did y'all know about that? Did you know your officers were taking training outside of the Dallas Police Department program? How to be aggressive. How to shoot and kill. Empty your clip. This is what they're being taught. Each one of you on the city council are directly responsible because you were their bosses. You have blood on your hands. You have committed genocide against the black community. We support the Office of the Police Monitoring. It is time for y'all to get up off y'all ass and do y'all job. Power to the people.
Your final speaker is Oakland.
I certainly appreciate the fact that members come down here, our citizens, to speak about particular topics. I take direct offense at being called genocidal. Being Jewish and having my people endured 6 million genocidal murders.
Hey.
I am talking now, and you can sit down.
Please
remove him.
Excuse me.
There is no comparison. There is no comparison to what is going on. We can control. We will absolutely take measures to make sure our police are treating everybody fairly and with dignity in the city. There's no question that is something, an objective that should happen across the city, across all racial and across all economic lines. Yes, that is important. But there's a big difference between what is going on with our police department and a Holocaust and genocide. And I just take offense at that. And if you want people on this council to listen to the things you have to say to us, you've got to treat us with the respect that you want us to treat you with. Thank you.
Your final speaker is Oakland Green.
My name is Olinka Green. Good morning. A human rights crisis confronts black people in the United States every day. There is no safe sanctuary for African Americans, not even here in Dallas, Texas. The operation for police monitor is very, very important to the people because we trust you and we believe that you're going to do your job. But we cannot trust you and believe you when our young black men and Latino men are being shot down in the back and the police officers do this, they walk. Now, the brother made the assessment about the Holocaust with the Jewish nation, which is true. But we also, as African Americans, have suffered a hell of a cost. That's what we call it. We are being shot down every day in the streets, whether it's by security guards or police officers. So somewhere, the stem must be stopped. The blood flow must be stopped. And so what we are asking, and maybe even having to demand, is that there be a stoppage. Because we know power comes from top. We know it starts at the top. So we're coming here and we're talking to you and we let you know that we are concerned about our young men, about our people in our community who are being shot down by police officers. As Brother Charles Goodson said, the only police officer that has ever been indicted was Darrell Kane, and that was for killing a Hispanic boy, Santos Rodriguez, in 1973, and it took, what, 2013, 2014 for that to be righted? So there is justification for the Office of Police Monitoring. I'm not going to sit here and cuss and rant and rave. I'm just going to make my point. Our young men have to walk outside the streets in fear. When Mark Cuban, who owns a basketball team, can make a statement like that, what does that say about those that are in power? We have young African-American men who go to the Mavericks games, but this gentleman is saying that he fears African-Americans in hoods. So something has to be said. There must be a dialogue. Until that dialogue is said, until there's somebody coming to the table and we're really, really, really making some headway, our young people are still going to die. Our young people are still going to be shot down the street. Our young people are still going to go through the cradle to the prison pipeline situation. We all know that African-American boys Prisons are built on third grade reading levels. We must understand that it's just not here at City Hall that we must start. We must start in the school districts. We must start at home. But we must also start with our children being able to trust police officers. But they cannot trust police officers when every time we turn on the television or we read the newspaper that they have been shot down and the officers find justification for shooting him. Oh, he lunged at me. Oh, he had his hands in his pockets. And this comes from how police justify shootings from the Malcolm X Project. It says, police officers, 47% of the police officers that shot young people said that they felt threatened. Right now, we have to start right now. We have to start with this situation, stopping the blood flow. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
Black
Power.
Ms. Davis.
Mr. Mayor, this concludes your morning speakers.
No, Ms. Davis.
First of all, I want to thank you, my sister, for coming down. We see each other over at Pan Africa Connection,
ma'am.
Which is in District 7. You know, I do believe that we must have a communication with Chief Brown.
Yes, ma'am.
I'll get with Chief Brown, AC, so we can at least start the communication.
He's right behind you right now.
Where's Chief Brown? Okay. Frustration can spill over sometime. And so I think we have to start the conversation, but we also have to respect others as we come to the mic.
Yes, ma'am.
And I think we have to respect others as we come to the mic. Now, I'm not going to go into detail. Some of this is our own fault.
Yes, ma'am.
Some of this is our fault. A lot of it is not our fault. Some of it is sometimes the brew of the past. Some of it is being poor from the past, and it's never healed, and it's spilled over from generation to generation to generation to generation. But at some point, we have to decide what we want to do as a community, because I live in District 7. I see people throwing trash out. I see people throwing buggy trash out. I see people doing things in their own hood to mess it up. Let me finish. Some of this is our fault. A lot of it is our fault. We don't want to deal with some of our own issues. We got mental health issues on our street. We got mental health issues. We got issues that we got to address. There are some kids who are not at James Madison and Lincoln High School right now, walking the street, deciding not to go to school this morning. That is our fault. We got to come together and deal with our own issues first before we can start demanding what we need of someone else. Our issues must be dealt with. And at the end of the day, Chief Brown going to sit down. He going to conversate with us. But we got some issues in our own. I live in South Dallas, born and raised, went to Charles Rice, went to James Madison High School. I know about the new Black Panther Party.
Yes,
I know Aaron Michael.
Yes, ma'am. Well, Ms. Davis, what I'm saying is...
Excuse me, Ms. Davis got the mic, please.
So, at the end of the day...
Right.
At the end of the day, this is just not Dallas. This is all over America.
Yes, ma'am.
So, we need to set up a meeting...
Okay.
...with Chief Brown, and it's going to be a meeting of the mind. So, to come down here, I've been black all my life, and I understand it. So... At the end of the day, we got to deal with our issues. And the issue is a lot of our problems in our community. So what I would like to see is us take some rakes, take some brooms, take a trash bag, let's go clean up our community.
Well, Ms. Davis,
Ms. Davis got the mic, please.
And so that's some things that we need to deal with. Let's go to AIPAC and let's deal with Joe Pyle. Volunteer to help those brothers who's on drug and alcohol abuse. Let's go into our schools and try to deal with some of those brothers and sisters who are not going to school. So we got to deal with all these issues. Okay? But my sister, and I let you talk. Okay. Let me talk.
Okay.
I understand. I do understand. But we got a whole lot of other issues that we got. But when we want to start talking about our problems, black on black crime, and all the other issues, then we want to walk away from it. And we want it as if it's everybody else's problem. Some of this is our problem. So when we heal that wound in the black community on black crime and some of the other issues that we're dealing with and we're facing, then I think we'll heal a lot of our own inflicted problems amongst us. That was the situation this morning that I had to deal with. It was black on black. But we got to talk about this stuff. That's why I was late, trying to deal with this problem.
Well, Ms. Caraway.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Green. Thank you very much.
Ms. Green, it's my time.
Ms. Caraway, thank you very much. Thank you.
And thank you for coming. I know your struggle, and I know your commitment. And I know the Panthers' commitment. I know the movement's their commitment, and I've seen it. I have the utmost respect for it. We'll do that.
And have our things done.
But let me say this. Okay, let me just say this one thing. One, Ms. Davis, thank you for what you're saying, Mayor. Thank you for allowing the response, and Mr. Kleinman, I certainly understand exactly your point. Let me say this one thing. When in my earlier comments to Cooper Caraway, I was complimenting, and I still compliment you all for coming down and taking a position and speaking. To echo on to what Ms. Davis is saying, one. You know, my motto has been since I've been on the city council, before we can ask people to come in, we got to clean it up. We understand that things have happened in the past, but today's society was not a part of the past, but we're dealing with past circumstances, okay? And they are unfair. We understand that. But there's a way and a strategic strategy that we have to go about it. And I think that what you all's position is a part of us getting to that point. Now, when we have some other meetings, and we will, okay, I'll commit to that myself, but we do have to do the very things that Ms. Davis is saying, and we have to first go and make sure that we're doing everything that we need to do to be collectively together, okay, within our community. I'm not putting people on Front Street, but some of our preachers are not together. Some of our community leaders are not together. Some of our neighbors are not together. And so we're going all different directions. I'm just suggesting when we do meet that we figure out first how we can band together and hold everyone accountable. We just can't hold the Dallas City Council accountable for things that a mother should do for her household, a father should do for his household, and that adversely comes out and affects us overall. So we're going to have to figure out some things. We got to figure out, let me finish now, Ms. Green. We got to figure out how we're going to get people engaged in education, how we're going to get the parents engaged, how we're going to have these PTA meetings, and more than two parents are going to show up instead of all the parents of each kid. We're going to have to make sure that when we're at our store, like my store at Walmart at Loop 12, I'm going to personally do a radio commercial over there because it ticks me off when I get out of the new store and trash is all over the parking lot. Well, it's over the parking lot because people are opening up their car doors and putting the trash out instead of putting it in, and it's nobody's responsibility but our responsibility to take care of our own community. I'm just using that as an example.
I understand, sir.
So now, what I want to do with you all, I'm going to sit down, we're going to meet. We're going
to
meet on these very issues. But I also want to suggest that we take this message to public safety. I would suggest that we meet with Chief Brown after we come together and get our thing together. Yeah, with Ms. Davis. I'm speaking in globally. But we meet with it. But we come together and we figure out and we hold everybody accountable. Let's hold the Dallas Black Chamber of Commerce accountable. Let's make sure that the services at MLK are collectively together. Let's make sure that we hold every little thing that's hurting us together and accountable. And then once we get everybody working together, the DA's office, the police department, the community, the churches, the preachers, the community leaders, the mothers, the fathers, and we get everybody together, then folks will start taking a look at where we're coming from, and then they'll know that we're greater in numbers. The numbers should not just be your group that's coming down. It should be a community at an outrage that is coming in here saying we've had enough and this is what we expect to have. I applaud you. We're going to be listening. We're going to meet. But we need to come down here and have these calm discussions,
right,
heated when necessary, but
right,
in respectful areas. But let's move toward a solution together. I hate to go so long-winded, but thank you very much. Thank
but
you.
But I would hope that we can have that conversation.
Excuse me, please, please.
We call a vegan double, we will get our people together, and I want to meet with you and Mrs. Davis.
Excuse me, we're going to do that. Yeah, Ms. Davis, thank you very much, you know, to inviting Chief Brown, Ms. Caraway, thank you very much. Also, there is numerous council members who came from South Dallas. I was right down Mill Place and Barr Street. Ms. Davis over there with Mr. Caraway, Ms. Davis, so we understand. But the point is, we do have a process and procedure. Chief Brown, AC, let us get together, get the community together, find out what all the issue is, Ms. Davis, and just find a meeting place and somewhere over there in Southern Dallas, whatever, and let us try to work things out. But in order to have a great city, we got to talk about things. Sometimes we overheat it. Sometimes we just need to calm down, find out how we deal with it. Thank you very much. Alvin Medrano, please.
Mayor Atkins, I move to suspend the rules and allow additional open microphone speakers. There's only two.
So what we're going to do, we're just going to take all the speakers and get it over with, and that way we won't have to worry about doing afternoon speakers. Thank you. No.
Your next speaker, DeAndre Upshaw.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I'm here today to bring to your attention an issue that is affecting people of color across the city of Dallas. Last month, I was turned away from a bar called Kung Fu Saloon for failing to meet a specific portion of their dress code. I asked the bouncers at the door what the dress code was and if it was posted. They would not tell me the dress code, and they told me that it was not posted. Several of the people I was meeting were wearing the same articles of clothing that I was turned away for wearing. The difference is that they are white and I am black. After leaving, I called the manager, who very angrily informed me that their dress code is not posted publicly and that it changes depending on who you know. After I shared my story online, dozens of people came forward and said that they were discriminated against at this same bar, once in a video of his party being turned away for wearing shoes without socks. They walked across the street and filmed as the bar allowed in patrons, white patrons, wearing shoes without socks. They then filmed the entire patio because it was summer in Dallas, everyone was wearing shoes without socks. This bar has locations in Houston and Austin, and they've made news for their discriminatory practices across the state of Texas. A perusal of comments left by patrons on their Yelp page shows that they have been actively refusing service to black people, Hispanic people, Asian people, and members of the LGBT community. We organized a rally several weeks ago, which was attended by almost 200 people. At the rally, an ex-employee stepped forward and said that she had been instructed by her employers to discriminate based on race. If someone called and had an ethnic-sounding last name, Rodriguez or Gonzalez, she was told to tell them that they did not have any vacancy and they could not book a room at the bar. Section 31-3 of the Dallas City Code states that if a place of public accommodation posts dress code, it has to be posted. Numerous bars in the area of Uptown and Dallas in general are failing to meet these requirements. They're turning away people of color, people of the LGBT community, because of who they are. Kung Fu Saloon and bars like it have been openly flaunting and ignoring these laws for years. In addition to videotaped evidence, dozens of statements, dozens of comments online, hundreds of people have contacted me and said they too have been discriminated against at this bar and other bars in Uptown. We have a petition signed by almost 1,000 people. We've had numerous press coverage in Dallas, Austin, and Houston. I urge the city of Dallas to take action against bars and restaurants in this city that are engaging in systematic discrimination against people of color and people in the LGBT community. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you very much, DeAndre. The bar in question is in District 14, which was very alarming to me. We don't discriminate in District 14 or in the city of Dallas. And businesses that violate our city codes will, in fact, be punished. However, I think in this situation, we may also have a chance for a little bit of learning, maybe some correction here. I think one of the good things about this council is we get along really well. And so Mr. Caraway and I are known to have a drink from time to time, and the next one might just be at Kung Fu Saloon. Just see what happens. Anyway, thank you for coming down here today. This is an issue that we won't let lie. That we just don't do that in Dallas, and we aren't going to tolerate people who do. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Caraway.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Mayor, and thank you, Mr. Upshaw. Let me just ask a couple of things. One, we're going to go out and have a cranberry straight up, so y'all can understand that's what's happening. And it'll be in a champagne glass. So. I've seen this and I've been following. I'm pleased that you've come down today.
Thank you.
That's number one. You'll never be heard unless you participate in the system and you're doing it in a very professional manner. One, there are bars across town that we don't know a lot of things about and that we should. I would suggest and say that this particular incident that unfortunately happened to you has opened up our eyes and has made us have to say to our police and to our enforcement here to go take a look, not just at the Kung Fu.
Yes, sir.
But let's take a look at our total bar and inspection and see where discrimination is. We're zero tolerance to discrimination, okay? And if it's happening in one, it could be happening in others. But then those that it is happening in should not be allowed to penalize the ones that do not.
Yes, sir.
So you've said a lot, and it has been heard, okay?
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask our staff, AC, to give me and us, but give me a report on the Kung Fu and other bars in the area, but all over the city of Dallas. But I want to know about the SUP. Are they currently under an SUP? What licenses do they have that we govern with the city? If indeed, because if it's an SUP, when is the SUP up for renewal and all of the status of Kung Fu, okay?
Yes,
so
sir.
I want to assure you,
thank
it's
you
been
so
heard. We'll exchange some information, and we'll see you from there.
I appreciate your time.
Mr. Medrano?
Yeah. DeAndre, thank you for coming today. And when I saw that you were coming to speak, I actually did my homework, and I have some friends that frequently visit that bar. Hispanic, African-American, Latinos, I asked them how they felt, and they've seen the same thing. They've seen the same thing. They've been treated the same way. I'm glad that Mr. Caraway and Councilmember Kingston and myself are going to be able to visit that location soon and try to see if we can come up with a solution. But colleagues, I mean, this is a serious problem with this bar. I'm not sure about any other ones, but definitely this bar. I sent a few text messages out to some folks to visit, and thank you again for coming and bringing this to our attention. Thank you
so much for having me. I appreciate you.
Jerry?
Yeah, I was just going to say, AC, once y'all do your investigation and whatever you find out, at the end of the day, Dallas, Texas, if what we're hearing turns out to be what it is, there's no place in Dallas, Texas, and I'd say the full force of city jumps in and makes them aware there's no place in the city for that and any other establishment.
So. Mr. Caraway?
I just wanted to ask one thing. You mentioned about no socks.
Yes, sir.
And ladies don't take this offensive, but are the ladies allowed to wear the sandals? I'm just wondering, is it a reason to justify socks, sandals,
no,
or bare feet?
No, sir. We, the people in question who sent in that video who were turned away from wearing shoes without socks, film the patio. I don't know if you've ever been there, but there's an open patio where you can see.
Okay.
And you can see men and women wearing, they wear those boat shoes without socks. I don't know if you've seen them. I wear socks with my shoes. But people have been turned away because they said that their shirt was too black. Not ethnically black, the color black. We've had people show up and be turned away, go change their entire outfit, come back, and still not be allowed in. A woman who's a white lady spoke at our rally and said that she and 15 people came. Her husband's black. He's the only black person in her family. They were all admitted in. He was not. He went home, changed clothes, was still not admitted.
And that's good. And Mr. King's not, I don't want to take a shot at my good friend, Commissioner John Wiley Price, but we're going to take him with us because he does not wear socks. He does not wear socks. But we're going to see if they're going to turn him away.
Well, they've been put on notice. We had three news crews in their face. So they have posted a dress code taped to their front door since this has happened. So it might... They've been put on notice. We had ABC, NBC, and CBS filming them.
Thank you, Mr. Upshaw. Let me get a couple points in, and also thank you, Mr. Kingston and Mr. Caraway, and also Mr. Medrano. But the key is that we are in a great city, and number one, if you accept my invitation, I give Mr. Grid, and I think we can go over there, Mr. Kleiman, and maybe, you know, the whole council just go over there and just visit the bar and sit down and see. Excuse me, we got one person who might not show up, but she probably be outside. Make sure we safe. Well, is she not safe? But anyway, but regardless, on a serious note, it's a serious issue. And any way you cut it, it's very serious that when you are in the city of Dallas, that discrimination is here. That is a serious issue, regardless what race, what color, what gender you are. That's a serious business in the city of Dallas, and that we're in a great city, and we're trying to make that city great. We need to do something about it. AC, Chief Brown, we need to find out what's going on, because these people would not come here when they say 1,000 of people come here. It's up to the city council and the policymaker to look into it, find out what's going on, to investigate, to do their due diligence. And we need to start doing that right away, because it's a serious point and a serious problem in the city of Dallas. And the council are responsible for policy. And we need to do our job to make sure the citizens have equality here.
If I might, we certainly will be getting back the report that was been asked for. We're going to be moving on it very aggressively. I just wanted to mention that there is an office. It's somewhat maybe a little misnomer. It's called Fair Housing. But in that office, the Fair Housing Office fields complaints on discrimination of all kinds for accommodations of whatever sort throughout the city. Let me just, if I might, the phone number is 214-670-4462. That's 214-670-4462. Beverly Davis, who is the head of that area, is in charge. I know she's been in contact with you. She will be pursuing that with the city attorney's office, with the city police department, to make sure that the appropriate information is put together, and if needed, legal action will be taken to see about correcting the situation.
Mr. Kingston, you have us.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. We'll be setting up. It's been too long since we all did a happy hour anyway, so we'll just be contacting.
I'll be with you.
We'll be contacting all the council members' offices and just get that on the calendar. I don't think we've
done it since. Can we go this afternoon?
Mr. Caraway, come on. Let's go.
We don't have no appointment to show up, do we?
All right. No, I don't think so.
We'll be there today. What time do they open?
We don't know. Okay. Next speaker.
Your next speaker is Jasper Bacchus.
He's not in.
Not present. Linda Newland. Not present. Mr. Mayor, this concludes your morning speakers. We'll now move to the voting agenda. Item 1, approval of minutes of the May 21st, 2014 City Council meeting.
Do we got a motion approving minutes? All in favor? Aye. Ayes carried. Next item.
Your second item is consideration of appointments to boards and commissions. This morning we have one individual appointment and one chair appointment. Being nominated to the Judicial Nominating Commission is Nicholas A. Cazeta by Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Alonzo, and Brett Rosenthal to the Permit as Chair to the Permit and License Appeal Board by Mayor Rawlings.
All in favor? Aye. Ayes carry. Next agenda item.
Mr. Mayor, your briefings follow.
Okay.
Let me just...
AC?
Yes, sir. Mr. Mayor and Council, this morning we'll be hearing a couple of briefings, the first one having to do with bicycle use ordinance. Keith Manoy, who has already presented this information, the quality of life, is going to be doing the presentation this morning to the full council. Keith?
Before we start that, I know there are a whole lot of concern with this particular item with a bicycle. That what I'm going to try to do is, number one, we're going to talk about it. Scott, I know you've been talking about it, and also Mr. Kingston, you've been talking about it also about the helmet. It's very concerned that AC, that when we finish this, I just want to try to move this to the addendum, you know, for next week on Friday to make sure we get ahead of the schedule. Because, number one, we do have rental bikes that come to the front part, and that might help them happen the summertime or whatever, so we need to find out what we need to do to go forward with this issue. So, Council, please understand what we're trying to accomplish today. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning. We're going to look at two sections of Chapter 9 of the Dallas City Code, which governs bicycle operations in the city, and for possible amendments. One is the all-ages group bicycle helmet requirement, and the second one is going to be the prohibition of bicycles inside public buildings. Two meetings have already been held in the last 2 months. For interested parties to come to the Quality of Life and Environment Committee to voice their concerns. On the May 12th meeting, the committee recommended advancing this to the full council for review, and here we are today. There were four speakers in that spoke that day. Five speakers that spoke that day. Four were in favor of removing the requirement for all ages, and one opposed. Our current bicycle helmet ordinance requirements say that any person commits an offense if he operates or rides a bicycle without wearing a helmet. A parent or guardian of a minor commits an offense if he knowingly allows their minor to ride or operate a bicycle without wearing a helmet. And the other parts of this section basically talk about riding with attached carriers, trailers, and things of that nature. Benefits of helmet legislation have been debated for several years. Proponents cite that a lower incidence of child mortality and bike-related head injuries are a reason to have legislation. Others cite that there are some states that have 20% lower rates of injury where helmet laws are present. Regarding helmets for adults, the research has been mixed and it's ongoing. Opponents of helmet legislation cite that they deter bicycle use and may become less effective for helmets and cyclists because they tend to be less careful. Helmet legislation generally does not change the rate of helmet use. Helmet laws are likely to discourage cycling and therefore have an unintended effect on the health benefits of cycling. Low-income citizens may not be able to afford bicycle helmets, and it's also been cited that helmet laws tend to target low-income minority neighborhoods. So there are two options for your consideration regarding helmet uses. One is to delete the helmet requirement entirely. No one will be required to wear a bicycle helmet. And the second option is to amend the ordinance to require helmets for minors only, and that would be individuals of 17 years of age or younger. The second item for your consideration regards the prohibition of bicycles in public buildings. And it simply says no one shall carry, propel, push, or ride an assembled or operable bicycle in a building in the city. The proposed change is to eliminate this prohibition altogether. And so one is no change to the ordinance, and two is deleted entirely. So with that, we're open for discussion.
Thank you, Mary Atkins. Let me just start on that last one about the no bikes in the building. Just eliminate that. You know, I was it was brought to my attention by Mr. Kleinman that because I have a couple of bikes down in the storage room. When y'all had that bicycle event here to ride from home, I rode from home, but I didn't ride back home, so I left it down in the storage. But in saying that, I think it would be sure to eliminate that because we do own the Dallas Police Department and the buildings, and they are city buildings, and they have those bicycles, and bicycles must be stored somewhere. And so we can't be selective as to which building it's going to be. If it's going to be a building that's going to be said, if this is going to be written to say no city building, then that means the Dallas Police doesn't have no place to put their bicycles. Do we put them in a city building, Chief? Where's the Chief? Anybody? They are in the city building. All right, so that's going to just eliminate that altogether, in my opinion. Next, I'm going to be with option two, the bicycle helmet, to say that we don't want it at all. The fact of the fight from years ago, the intent of this was to protect children more or less than just everybody riding a bike, but primarily more for children. Adults, as I see in the Dallas Morning News, where they say today that the enforcement is unevenly. That's okay. We'll get into that at some point. But here's a gentleman that's riding on the front page, and he has his Kangol hat on at White Rock. Okay? There's another guy on the other page. He has his slick golf hat on. He's riding his bike, but they are adults. Okay? And so I'm going to be for option two, Mayor, as relate to this particular issue.
Okay, Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And let me, council members, let me just start by saying we've had this twice at Quality of Life, and I really want to thank Mr. Caraway for his leadership on this. The issue is not as simple as it looks on its face. If you're thinking about, am I going to delete a helmet ordinance, what's going to happen the minute somebody gets, you know, falls off a bike and gets a head injury? Are we going to be responsible for that? And the answer is no, and here's why. There are a couple of issues about helmet ordinances. You got to remember that a helmet ordinance is not the same thing as making people wear helmets. And if you go back to slide 5 for a moment, people are advocating that there's a lower incidence of child mortality and head injuries and that injury rates are lower. There is no data backing up those claims. The data are pretty clear at this point. There's a new study out of Canada recently that shows no correlation between bike helmet ordinances and rates of head injury. So if you're worried about, am I causing a public health danger here, I want your mind to be at ease on this a little bit. What we're essentially doing is allowing the city to do bike share. The program that I don't think is very good at Fair Park will not be successful if we require people to have helmets. Ultimately, we want bike share throughout the city, and that program really requires that we delete the helmet ordinance. And those are the kind of the safest trips also. So the people who are doing bike share from point to point are not going to be overly endangering themselves, but if we require them to wear helmets, the bike share program will not be successful. Additionally, we're probably suppressing the rate of adoption of bicycles as transportation or recreation by having the helmet ordinance. Now, let's be clear. I wear a helmet. I want you to wear a helmet. If you need me to help you find a helmet, I will take you over to Richardson or to Transit or one of the other bike shops and show you which one you need. They're not expensive. Everybody should wear one, especially if you're biking for commuting purposes or you bike regularly for recreation. But in terms of forcing people to wear them, I think the morning news's coverage today is very valid. This ordinance was intended to drive a public safety and public health benefit. It hasn't done that in any way, shape, or form. It has been used as a law enforcement tool. That is not a criticism of the police. They have a job to do. And when you hand them a criminal ordinance, they do the job the same way every time.
They use it to climb the Fourth Amendment ladder toward doing more investigation of people they think are doing bad things. It means there's been no enforcement of the helmet ordinance at White Rock because they're really not trying to catch drug dealers at White Rock. It means that all of the enforcement has been in the hotspot areas. And that's not, again, it's not a criticism. That's what happens when you hand police a criminal tool. They use it to go try to catch criminals. They don't use it to make sure that kids are safe from falling off their bikes. So that's another reason I think that I'm going to ask you to support deleting the ordinance in its entirety. Even though we want to make sure that minors are protected, all of us want to make sure that our kids are safe. I just don't believe that the ordinance is the way to get there. We need to model that behavior. When I'm riding my bike, you'll see me with a helmet on. When we talk about biking, we need to talk about the importance of using helmets. But what we don't need is a criminal ordinance that requires criminal enforcement and then is used by the police in their normal. Their job is not to wander around and make sure that everybody's wearing their helmets. Their job is to stop crime, and that's how they've used this ordinance. So I really appreciate this. It's a little bit of a complicated issue, and I'm really appreciative of the Quality of Life Committee for digging in and understanding it. Mr. Manoy has done a good job presenting the data we have, and I really appreciate Jared White's work on this. The Bicycle Task Force made this a priority, and council has responded to it. But when you're thinking about it, don't be too scared about some wave of increased head injuries. I don't think we'll see it. But also, when you compare it to the public health benefits of increased cycling, I think this is actually a pretty easy call. So I'll appreciate your support for repealing it entirely. I have to tell you that Mr. Kleinman and Mr. Griggs, Mr. Medrano and I and the task force really appreciate your attention to this issue. It might seem like a small thing, but I think it's going to have a big impact in terms of vibrancy in our city. Thank you.
Mr. Kleinman.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Philip. I think you covered a lot of this issue very well. I also will be supporting the recommendation to repeal this part of the ordinance. I ride here a lot, and I ride to other places, and I wear a helmet all the time. People need to take personal responsibility for themselves and for their children, and I don't feel that just having an ordinance in place necessarily changes that behavior. One thing I would like to ask you, Keith, is you did not address Section 9-3, stunt riding. Why did we not look at removing that as well, where it's against the law to ride with both hands off the handlebars or feet off the pedals or practice any acrobatic or stunt riding on any street? Why did we not look at removing that?
When this comes forward for your consideration, if you would like to have that included, we can do that. We didn't specifically look at that primarily because we weren't asked to.
Okay. Yeah. I think as we have an opportunity in our code to look at, in my view, things that just either aren't applicable or aren't enforceable. I think that's another item. So appreciate y'all addressing that. And hopefully we can also repeal the in-building component so that I can come in compliance when I hang my – I'm sorry, not hanging my bike in my office. That's a piece of artwork hanging in my office.
Correct.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Medrano.
Oh, I'm going to – and we've discussed this several times in our committee. I am going to support option two. Is option two the one with 17 and the protection of the children? Yeah, that one. Option two.
Okay. Ms. Allen, Jerry.
I've stated several times over the last 7 years for folks that are of legal age, for the most part, they ought to be able to do what they want to do. You got to have protections that are out there, but sometimes not too much protection. But I have stood up for the kids, and we have to stand up, so I'm going to support option two. It is about behavioral control. That's all this stuff is, as we do a lot of the things, whether it's the seat belts. I personally don't wear a seat belt. Probably one of the few people
Jerry?
That don't. And I have my own reasons for not doing so. But But from a behavioral control point, everybody from early age, they get in and they put that seatbelt on and it becomes accustomed to it. Today with bicycles, same thing. If you start wearing that helmet early on, slide six, I'm not going to go into it. To me, that's a bunch of bull. Those statements, it's just ridiculous, those statements. But so I'm not going to address how ridiculous they are. From we saw the Dallas Morning News. And it's really neat the way they all of a sudden they put it out today. You know, they were having this briefing, and they put these two old boys on that paper. Put these two old boys out there at White Rock Lake. Well, guess what? You know, in this briefing, they didn't talk about the deaths, how many deaths there are, how many deaths we have throughout for bicycles throughout the United States.
That I'm not sure of. I'd have
it's
to.
Over 700 a year. How many other accidents, near fatalities do we have?
I don't have all the crashes.
About 35,000. And so... and what's the average age of the ones that that are more like most likely to have a death? So it's two white guys that are on that paper. That's the average age. Those two white guys that are in the paper are the ones that are going to be killed. And so so it's in that 40 range is the ones that will be killed on their bicycles. But they're over 21, so they made that conscious decision to do so. So anyway, I'm not in favor of eliminating it because I think from a human behavioral standpoint, you need to have that behavior in there for the kids to come up so they're used to it of wearing the helmet. There's no question that a helmet will protect you in an accident. So the statistics are there. So I will support option number two.
Ms. Alonzo.
Mr. Mayor,
okay. Mr. Caraway, you was
number two.
Okay. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would be in favor of letting adults without a helmet, but I would so option number two. But the children, I think, I think personally, responsible adults or parents should also wear one if they're asking, you know, their child to. But we have other laws, like related to life preservers on boats, only children, not adults. I know my own family, my brother always wears his life jacket if he has his kids wear theirs. So I think it's a good example. But it's the adults have the option, but the children, I think the ordinance is appropriate. And then I do also think we would eliminate this random enforcing because that's not going to happen with the children. It would only be – I think that's only happening with the adults. So that corrects any concerns about that.
Mr. Grizz.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you for this briefing for city staff. I believe we also have our new bicycle coordinator. Is that the title here?
Yes,
I don't know if the whole council had a chance to meet you or not.
Okay.
Well, stand up just real quick so everyone will know who our new bicycle coordinator is.
Miss Ashley Hare.
Well, great. I'm pleased, as Mr. Kleiman said, that we'll be moving forward with allowing bicycles in buildings. That's very antiquated. That's one of those things you don't know, looking back on it, how it ever got into the Dallas City Code, so I'm pleased we'll be moving forward with removing that. With these two options, I'll be supporting option two. I believe adults have the right to make their own decisions, but with children, we should require them to wear a helmet. Particularly, this is a balance between encouraging health. It's easier to ride your bike if you don't have a helmet, but on the other side, it's safety. And I would like Dallas to be at a place where we could be option one all the time, where it would be a safe place to ride without a bicycle helmet. But the reality of the city of Dallas is we're still very car-centric, and we still have a large number of arterials and people that move rapidly in cars. And being so dependent on cars, whenever there's an accident and it's a car and a bicycle, the cars win every time. They have an absolutely undefeated record and defeat the bicycles every time. So if adults want to make their own decisions, that's fine with me. But I believe for children, this isn't the only way to dictate behavior, and this alone will not make all children wear bicycle helmets, but I believe it's a good idea. Simply in the interest of protecting children, as we do in other areas and other laws, setting a behavioral standard, as Jerry said. So for that, I will be supporting option two, because I don't believe Dallas being where we are. I wish we were a more walkable, bikeable public transit city, but we're not there yet. I believe we will be there someday. But based on where we are today, I believe option two makes sense, and so that's the one I will be supporting. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Ms. Hia.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I will not support any repeal of the bike ordinance either for children or adults. I do believe that it is a safety issue. I find that it is analogous to seatbelts. We require seatbelts for all age persons, and I think helmets on bicycles should be required for persons of all ages. It is true that adults have the right to make their own decisions, but I do believe that regulations help people to make decisions that are more safe. And because we are an automobile-centric city, I do think that every measure possible should be taken to help people make the decision towards safety. I also believe that helmets prevent injuries, and I do not believe that requiring helmets will discourage bicycle use in any manner. Bicycles in buildings, that doesn't bother me, but on the helmets, I am adamant, and I will not support repealing the ordinance for either adults or children. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Callahan.
Thank you, Mayor. This is one of those save us from ourselves, you know, type laws on those feel-good things. I think we, when we created that back in, what, 96, it was just one of we felt good about ourselves. We actually got some legislation passed, and I did an analysis, or actually had it done by Chief Lawrence, and very low number of tickets written since the inception of this, not only in my district but citywide. It was virtually really nil. I do agree with Councilman Kingston. It's one of those things where it gives the police just one more opportunity to pull you over and stop you. You know, what are you doing wrong? I just think people should make their own decisions, you know, on the helmets. Let's protect our kids, you know, certainly in favor of that. And I'm not advocating by repealing a portion of the law that we should not encourage the wear of helmets. You know, I think if people want to wear one, I'll still wear mine when I'm in the cycling events. You know, if I'm riding down the street, I might not. If I'm riding to the store, I might not. I'd like to make that decision on my own. I do think this will help us in our bicycle rental process, you know, just makes it much simpler because, again, having the availability of helmets, you're not going to see people walk up or get off the bus and have their helmet under their arm. I think it comes down to a sanitary thing. I do think there's a way to probably get a disposable liner that maybe we can just buy, you know, maybe rinse or wipe or wash the helmets out and then just snap in the new disposable liner, which could be purchased, you know, for maybe a couple of $3-5 and then disposed of or recycled, you know, later. So that might be the way to go. But I'm going to support option two, encourage our kids. Obviously, we keep that within the law. But as far as adults, I think we're big enough to make our own decisions on that type of thing. So that's the direction of my vote. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Ms. Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First of all, I want to thank Chair Carraway for letting us discuss this and the quality of life. As I said, in the quality of life, I'm going to have to support option two if we're going to have to make a decision. I think at least kids should have a right to wear a helmet. I also agree that it should be that when kids are wearing helmets, that these outlets need to push or talk about this issue more, even at Fair Park. So I don't know how they're going to do it at Fair Park, Let me ask you something. Are they going to have helmets? Are they going to have bikes for smaller kids at Fair Park, or just going to be for adults only?
My understanding is for adults.
Only?
Only.
Okay. And at Fair Park, will they have helmets as well if they want to wear them?
Well, as of right now, they will be required to have helmets.
Okay. At Fair Park?
At Fair Park.
Okay. Okay, then. So, Mr. Mayor, my vote will be option two today.
Ms. Dane.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Keith, what is the motorcycle ordinance on helmets? Do you know that?
I don't know, but my understanding, I don't think they're required to wear helmets.
I don't either. And we're requiring them to wear them with bicycles, which I would think is a lot less dangerous in the motorcycles, but on the other hand, I do want to see the young kids wearing helmets, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to back probably, and I'm not for telling folks you got to wear a helmet or you don't have to wear a helmet. I don't think it's our job. I think they should have the sense enough to wear the helmet, but I'll probably end up backing a motion too. And then on the other ordinance you had prohibited in buildings, you're talking about taking that out.
That's
Is
correct.
That correct? To where you can bring them in buildings.
Correct.
Okay, I just wanted to understand that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Kingston.
Hey, thank you for round two, Mr. Mayor. I just wanted to add a couple of things. One of the I think when we had discussion about this in quality of life, we had some discussion about the option two. And everyone wants to protect kids. I understand that. But you're not doing it with this ordinance. This is appearance and no substance, except it will have an effect on families that come to visit Dallas, maybe stay at the Omni and try to use our bike share when we get it installed there, and the parents can take a bike share bike and the kids cannot. So, I mean, just think about the unintended consequences of the regulation you're considering. And Judge Hill's point is very well taken, that if it's a public safety issue, that changes the game. What I'm telling you is we've got lots of data. You can look at the record from quality of life. These ordinances simply do not have a public safety benefit. I mean, the seat belts have been proven quite clearly to save lives. Ordinances like these simply do not. The other thing I wanted to ask, Keith, you said 17 and under, but actually the ordinance we're considering is under 17, 0 to 16, right?
Yes.
Okay. A 16-year-old kid can legally, without a helmet, operate a 200-horsepower motorcycle on our city streets without supervision of anybody, without asking permission. Something that can go 0 to 60 in under 3 seconds, can top out at 170 miles an hour, no helmet. And we're gonna keep this ordinance in place? Just, I understand everyone wants to protect the kids, but don't go for a slogan. Look at the substance. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Carraway.
Thank you. Let me ask a couple of things. First of all, let me just respond to Mr. Kingston with a 16-year-old. That's the 16, and that's true. But then you have the 11-year-old, you have the 8, the 5, the 4, the 3, and the 13 that are not on the motorcycles. But you're correct with the 16-year-old, but you still have other kids that are the babies that have to be protected. And when this ordinance was created and first thought of by other councils, it was all about safety, and it was more of the safety of the kids. That was the intent, even than the adults. The kids that are at Children's Hospital with head injuries that were sustained by way of bicycle without helmet accidents. One legal question that I would ask, if, and you all can answer from the back, if and when we pass this new ordinance,
as related to the kids, and then in response to the bike share program, if we by law pass this and it is required in the city of Dallas to for kids under 17 to have a helmet, does that automatically force the bike share people to have to supply or have available, made available to kids the helmets? Or are we going to say that the bike share program, and when visitors come, and I'm hearing, you know, our concerns about when the visitors come, that only adults can rent the bike share program, the bike share?
Well, if the ordinance continues to require minors of some age to wear helmets, that would apply whether it was a personally owned bicycle or a rented.
Okay. So it would be advantageous for the bike share people to make some form of a helmet available as well, because by law, in order for a family to come and to ride the bike, the kid has to have a helmet. And then it goes back into Mr. Callahan's statement of some type of a liner, and I would just think that the bike share people need to begin to kind of think creatively. They're going to rent more bikes to adults. They're not going to have many of the kids, I would not believe, to have the bikes. I don't see, and they may. Tell me, correct me. Don't let me get too far out
now,
here.
The bike share program are generally set up for kids that are 17 and older. They're not
okay
bicycles for children.
Okay, well, good. So it's set up for 17 and older.
Yes.
Okay, so that's why I said, don't let me get too far off base.
Yeah.
Why y'all let me get that far in all that water?
You threw up the screen.
Okay. All right. So if indeed, okay. Well, let me close with this. And thank you, Mayor. If indeed, should they rent to people, and I said should they rent to children, then it will be required for them to have some form of a helmet. Okay, even though it is set up for 17, should they bend the rules, should that be a part of their policy, then that they would need to have the helmet.
Correct.
Okay.
You want to speak again, Ms. Gates? No, she wouldn't last. You want to speak, Ms.
I already spoke.
Ms. Grayson?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I was going to support option two, but I'd like to suggest that we do it for 13 and under. I know Mr. Kingston wants option one, but I still think for kiddos, but he makes a good point about motorbikes, motor scooters, and things like that. I mean, if they can ride that without a helmet, I think that they don't need to have a helmet for a bicycle. So my suggestion would be 13 and under, an option two, or maybe an option three with 13 and under. And then this is totally unrelated, but I got to ask you guys, did you, like, consult each other about what to wear today? Because you're wearing exactly the same thing. I mean, it's, like, amazing. It's like you got a memo or something. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
They're roommates.
So
Mr.
Mayor.
Okay.
Jerry. Just real quick. I do want to go back to the public safety issue, and without question, it's a public safety issue. If it's not a public safety issue, why do grown-ups wear helmets? They don't wear helmets to look cool. It's public safety. So don't tell me it's not about public safety, because it is, or you're not going to buy that helmet. So it is important. But again, I believe in the freedom to allow people to do what they want to do. As far as the age limit, you can go back and it's right there by state, and it tells you what the laws are by city, and it tells you the age limit by city. And you can do the average age that you've got. They go anywhere from 18 years to, 17, some down to 16. Louisiana, the state, is 12, under 12 years old. You have to wear a helmet. But majority of the cities probably would cut it off at that 17, maybe, probably on average, it's that 17 age that you've got. excellent point about the motorcycle. You know, that is very true. But at some point, you got to cut it off. So whether it's 16 or 17, I still say the most important part of it is nothing more than behavioral control, having the conversation, understanding the safety. Mayor Atkins and I, back when the Super Bowl was here, got quite involved because of the Super Bowl. They had the concussions, and the discussions was going on concussions. The Super Bowl was building that discussion, and Mayor Atkins and I became rather involved in that, and you can see where that discussion has gone. Conversation, behavioral control, early age is what it's about. Thank you very much.
Gates.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would still be supportive, and I'm not. I might be flexible on the age, but of requiring the minors to have helmets. I think if we do have the bike share program in place, we could work with hotels and make them aware of the ordinance. They possibly could have helmets available for children. And make that aware to our visitors in Dallas. And I know people are worried about sharing helmets, but the hotels also could have the spray, or they could offer shower caps are good to protect your head when you're sharing a helmet. So, thanks.
Mr. Greer.
Thank you. Just wanted to have Chief Brown come up and clarify on the ordinance for the, what it is for the, I know there's some question about the ordinance for the motorbikes. At what age the helmet begins?
Yeah, we were citing the transportation code on the motorcycle helmet requirement. It's specifically for adults. Adults are defined as 17 and older. So if you're 16 riding a motorcycle, you would have to wear a motorcycle helmet. Now, whether they do all the time or not is another question altogether.
Yes. Okay, so just to clarify, option two is consistent with our motorcycle ordinance?
It's the transportation code, yes.
Okay. This was just clarifying. Thank you, Chief. And also, as I found out having children now, if you're going to make plans, you pack. I mean, starting off now, I got to do a stroller, I got to do a car seat, we got to do this bag, and this is just to go down the street. Much less planning this trip, maybe. You know, we can go see the grandparents down in the valley. So if we were going to go swimming or something, we'd have to pack the swimsuit or pack the swim diapers, pack the floaties. And I'm told that this is going to go on for years by people who have been through. And that it may even get worse. So I can imagine as my daughter gets older and we want to go somewhere and we're thinking about the pool, we're going to have to pack her favorite float or swimsuit for. And then I imagine if we're going to stay at an Omni in another city, we might have to pack her helmet for her and probably her favorite riding outfit. It'll just be one more thing to pack as a parent. So that, I don't see that as a huge obstacle, because you get trained from day one and you can't even leave the hospital without all the stuff. So it just continues from there. So that, going to another hotel, and as Dallas gets to be known as a city for riding bikes, I can imagine that people say, well, we're going to go to Dallas. They got this great bike riding program. They'll pack the kid's bicycle helmet and other things the kid likes when they ride their bike, maybe their favorite horn. And so that I don't really see as an obstacle. So I think option two is the way to go. I'm pleased to hear from the chief that, hearing from you, that option two is the same, would make us the same for bicycles as for motorcycles. Because, again, it's not so much what the To me, it's not so much what the child is on, but it's what's impacting them. Since a car has so much more mass and typically has a lot more velocity, it's that kinetic energy to be afraid of. Kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. So that's what you're afraid of. The heavier automobile hitting a child with a lot of velocity, not so much what they're on, even if they're standing there. And the concern with not only bicycles but motorcycles and anything else, you're bringing potentially a higher likelihood of the two things being in the same space at the same time. So in that instance, for safety, I'd still like to continue with option two. Thank you.
Ms. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Greg should know that does go on for a long time. My son is now 21, about to be 22, but I remember well packing all that junk. It takes half the car, and it goes on a long time. But the days are long, but the years are short. That's an aside. As to the motorcycle helmets, if I had the opportunity to decide that issue, which I do not because that's a state issue, but if I had to decide it, I would decide the same way, that everyone should wear a helmet who's on a motorcycle as well. That, too, is a safety issue. The head injuries are enormous, and if a helmet saves just one person from being in a wheelchair and the other things that happen to people who are injured on motorcycles, I'm for it. But just to be clear, I'm not being inconsistent. I simply do not have a say at this time in the motorcycle statute. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Caraway.
Okay,
Ms. Kingsley.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Mayor. Chief Brown. Tell me how a patrol officer will identify a 16-year-old on a bicycle.
Well, it's difficult. Some 16-year-olds look more mature, but generally we don't find, outside of the White Rock Lake, Katy Trail, maybe downtown area, you don't have many adults neighborhoods where we're really looking at enforcing traffic laws. Young people are not easy to identify, but you can identify young people on bikes. Yes.
Let's be real specific. If you pull somebody over for being potentially underage and not having a helmet on, that's a constitutionally infirm stop. That's not reasonable suspicion.
You make a good point.
You can't write these tickets. You guys are giving me, I really appreciate all the commentary about, you're still confusing, colleagues, respectfully, wearing a helmet with an ordinance requiring wearing a helmet. The ordinance doesn't drive the result you want. It simply doesn't work, and that's why I'm favoring option one. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
A couple questions is, how much do a bike helmet cost?
As low as $20, $30 and up.
The standard price is?
I've paid $35 for just kind of a moderate helmet.
What about a child bike? Same price?
A child's bicycle or a helmet?
A helmet.
I'm assuming it's the same price. I haven't purchased one.
When we look at, I was just curious what the price of the helmet, and also look at a price, especially for a child helmet. You know, that taking consideration the cost, you know, to do that. What is the citation for not wearing a helmet? How was the cost for that?
I think your first offense, it's $10, something like that, and then it goes up incrementally.
So the first is $10?
I believe so.
So who knew that answer? Chief, anyone know? Warren, anyone know? The $10, right? But you don't pay the $10 the first time you go buy a helmet. You don't have to pay the citation. Is that correct?
Yeah,
is that correct?
I understand it, yeah.
So therefore, you will fine someone $10 with a citation. If you go buy a helmet, you waive the citation because you bought the helmet. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm just trying to get clarification. You want to say something?
Well, Mr. Kleinman brought that up, that you can't write a citation. Mr. Kingston, isn't that correct?
Right now you can't.
No, even with this ordinance, if they stop...
If
they stop someone and say, oh, how old are you? They can't write that citation. Is that correct? Isn't that what I just heard?
I don't know.
Isn't that right, Chief?
Yes.
Okay.
So what's the ordinance for?
Okay, get to the point. The point is, number one, is there a state law about helmet and sailors? Is there a state law?
No, not in the state of Texas.
Have anyone tried to lobby state law for helmet inside the state of Texas?
Yes.
What happened?
It was unsuccessful.
So what city or who led the charge?
I'm not sure what city led the charge.
Okay. Okay. Citation. How many citations have been written for no helmet?
In the city of Dallas?
The city of Dallas, right.
Since its inception, I believe the number is about 6,700.
6,700?
Correct.
How much money have we collect on citation?
That I don't know.
Who know that answer? Staff? Could you retrieve that information before Friday?
Yes, sir.
Can you also say how much money have we collect in citation? Do we know that else?
No, sir. We can get that.
Okay. You know, safety is very important, you know, that I see, but also how do we enforce the issue? I mean, I'm looking at how do you enforce that. Do we know AC in Fair Park when we start our bike sharing, when that might come to reality? When?
I think that, Keith, if you can, if you all would answer that.
I may need to defer to Park Department. I'm not sure exactly what their schedule is for the launch of bike sharing.
It's coming online the end of June,
mid-June. So we need to come up with some kind of decision before mid-June, before we is there going to be a private company run that operation? They're going to be public-private. You know how they're going to? Is it going to be a private company running that, or going to be a public-private partnership doing this? So it's public-private, right?
Yes.
Okay, if we do this, what about education? If we change this, how are we going to educate the citizens of Dallas? If we go with option two. Do we have an education program?
We currently have, on the city's website, we have a bicycle section that talks about the programming that we have, and it gives facts about bicycle usage. So that's available to us. Our bicycle coordinator currently does a bicycle blog. We also have available the numerous bike-friendly organizations around the city that are engaged with us, and they will also help get that word out.
AC, if you're going to change this, and we got to June the 25th, you know, I'm looking at the average parents. You know, they're not going to go to the website. They don't know the law has changed, but we need to come up with some kind of education to how we're going to do it. It's going to be a cost, or what the cost is going to be. Those are things that we need to, the citizens need to know, how you're going to advertise this.
Well, first of all, if you're talking about moving from a requirement where everybody has it, and now they're not.
Right.
The fact if somebody isn't wearing it, they're not going to be stopped. If you were headed in the other direction, you might have more of a need. But this in this particular case, you're going in direction of less enforcement.
But you're also going to say if you said that we had no helmet, but you're going to put required age of 12 and under, so there is a need to, someone got to be educated, because right now you're going to rewrite this, so I'm going to try to find how we're going to make sure the public knows what we are doing.
Well, again,
we won't know that until after the vote, so I'm going to try to make sure you have some kind of option in place.
I think Keith laid out the various ways that the information would be out, but again, you would be going to a less restrictive condition, and so therefore those people that were previously informed about having a requirement for their children, they're still going to be, if you have option two, they'd still have that requirement.
Okay.
In addition, I would say it's pretty safe this is going to be on the front page of morning news, judging by
everybody will read the morning news.
But
morning news, some people don't even take the morning news.
I understand that, but that is one
way
that the information
will
be disseminated.
Besides the morning news.
Well, and we will work to do that.
Right. Thank you. With that, colleagues, I think if y'all had any questions about the option to change, make sure you get it back to staff, and And we are going to put this on addendum so everybody knows we'll be on addendum before 5 o'clock. So therefore, don't come back next week and say, I didn't know anything about it. Okay, next item.
The next briefing has to do with Housing Plus. And as we change speakers, hopefully Teresa's. Okay, I guess I am going to be warming up the crowd while the main event shows up. Basically, the briefing was given to the Housing Committee with regards to our plans to be moving forward with a housing strategy that will be more comprehensive than the approach that we have had in the past. What you will be seeing today is the outline of the approach that we are undertaking to involve numerous groups and individuals to be making sure that as we look at changing the way that we're looking at or the way that we would be implementing our housing programs in the future, that they would be, one, more holistic, that they would be in greater coordination with HUD with regards to fair housing, that they would also make sure that we are addressing the various issues that impact on neighborhoods. In this briefing is also a timeline in order to see about implementing this strategy, which involves some homework on your all's part as council members to be pulling together your respective communities to see about how they might benefit from this new approach. With that, Teresa.
Thanks for stalling, AC. Thank you. So this morning what we're going to do is go through pretty quickly, just kind of the planning process, our planning team that we're going to approve, and ask for your consideration of the contracts on June 25th. So with that, what I'm going to touch on are the consultants and the planning team. Many of you already are kind of aware of how we're doing this. I want to spend some time stressing the importance of partnerships in this effort, that we can't do it alone, that the city resources really are just a drop in the bucket. We'll outline some of the major milestones and timelines. The plan is going to take about a year. We hope to have a draft plan by December, but we understand that there's going to be a strong appetite to see some progress on some early initiatives, so we'll go through some of those. One of the most important parts of the plan, of course, is public engagement. Not only is it a requirement of the consolidated plan, it's just a good idea when you're developing public policy and you're shifting as much as we are going to be shifting here. Talk about some funding and then the council action and next steps. So with that, I'm going to get started. As you all recall, but maybe more for the sake of the audience, we kind of launched this back in December timeframe when we received a letter from HUD questioning some of our current investment kind of strategies and practices. And, of course, it was a good time to look at how the housing department was operating. The federal funding continues to decline. The regulations continue to change. And in addition to that, if anybody who reads the paper, of course, knows that our housing market is so hot right now that some people are selling their houses before they even go on the market. Yet vast areas of Dallas still are seeing decline and stagnation in the housing market. We're just not having good market response in many areas of Dallas. So it's a great time to look at that and to see how we can be a catalyst. The city's investment can be a catalyst into these neighborhoods. The council was briefed on March 5th, and we introduced Ms. Mercedes Marquez at that time. Since then, we've been thinking quite a bit. We've been doing some early research and thinking quite a bit about this team that we need to put together. And what we're proposing for you today is put down really this national panel of experts. Mercedes Marquez, of course, will be our thought leader. She has a resume that I think is unparalleled in the United States today in terms of working in fair housing and community development. Don Babers has had a long and very, very stellar career at HUD. He's recently retired after 40 years with the organization and was our regional administrator for, I think, 15 years. And then in terms of the strategic policy analysis and the public outreach, many of you have worked with Mr. John Fregonesi before, Fregonesi and Consultants. Let's go ahead and hop a little bit. Robin, one more. John, let's go back. John, as many of you know, he's been a professional planner for more than 30 years. He was the planning director for Portland's Regional Planning Authority, which is, of course, probably the best planning authority in the United States. He's had his private consulting firm for 17 years. He's worked in Dallas for a number of different projects. But he's also very well versed in housing plans. He did a regional housing plan for Chicago a few years ago, which was an award-winning plan. And so we're privileged to have his expertise on that as well. Then the bulk of the technical analysis and the kind of regulatory review, we're asking for HUD to give us assistance. They have an internal consulting team that they refer to as one CPD. We've made a formal request of HUD to provide this assistance for us. Pierre and I and Robin will be talking to them later today to start to outline the specific requests that we're going to have. Not only can they give us an assessment of our current programs and policies, but they can also recommend some best practices, and they can bring in some national partners to help us understand how Dallas's housing strategy can be really a best practice for the United States. We kind of, to put a dollar figure on that amount of assistance, would probably be in the $350,000 range. Dallas won't have to pay for that. That will be HUD's contribution to the plan. So let me change gears for just a minute and talk about partnerships. We talked a little bit about HUD, but we certainly recognize the fact that we can't do this ourselves. We think one of the very key strategies in developing this plan is to formalize partnerships with our other philanthropic institutions in the city and nationally, some of our industry groups, some of our government partners, not only HUD, but EPA, the county. We understand that community health and neighborhood health is going to be a very important part of this strategy. The CHOTOs, of course, some of our CHOTOs are here today, and we're always grateful to have them working in the city of Dallas and have them on board with this plan. We also want to use this effort to build some new partnerships, not only with local institutions, but also with national institutions. There are some national nonprofits that just currently don't work in Dallas, and we need to develop that. We need to develop those relationships, build that capacity, and welcome those institutions back into Dallas. We also want to engage some national housing experts. There's a few firms like Mr. Fregonesi's firms, like McCormick Merrick Salazar, that are very successful in receiving some of these big national grants, like the Promise Neighborhoods grants, the Choice Neighborhood grants. We want to be able to access that money. As funds continue to decline, that is one way to increase our federal kind of share of dollars. So we want to be able to do that, too. We've already had a lot of initial conversations with many of these firms, and we've had great, great response. I can't tell you how excited people are to hear about this outreach effort. They want to be a part of helping Dallas improve and grow and expand housing opportunities and housing choice for people. And everybody has offered to help. Everybody's offered to help. They want to be engaged. They want to contribute. So we're very excited about that. So just to go briefly through some major milestones, we did have our Fair Housing Symposium back in April that was well attended, and I think everybody that came thought it was informative and a good initial conversation on some of the issues that Dallas needs to be thinking about and working on. We had a great committee meeting on Monday with the Housing Committee. Ms. Marquez came, and we engaged the committee in some very good discussion, not only about identifying problems, but start to look at some aspirational goals and some visions for what this plan should be able to achieve. We'll be preparing a more in-depth council briefing for the 18th, so you'll get a little more meat about the planning process at that time. This is really more of an overview. The consultant contracts we'll place on the June 25th agenda for approval. And then we're going to do the soft launch of this plan at a council workshop on June 26th. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, a little bit more about that in a minute. But what we really want to do is do kind of a soft launch for that, kind of beta test some ideas we have with you all, and get some guidance and policy direction, and then really kick off the community engagement in August and September with a big block party and 5 or 6 community workshops. So we're very excited about that. We think it'll be fun. We think it'll be informative and start to understand how this plan is going to work. This is a process timeline. As you can see, the public engagement, these kind of blue stars down here, really will be happening this summer. Then by October, we'll be drafting this plan. This will be coordinated with the draft of the next consolidated plan. That also starts in October. So it's important that those two things are parallel. And, of course, it's the beginning of our fiscal year. So it'll give us an opportunity to think about some restructuring and some budgets. But as I said, we understand that December, January is going to be a long time for the council and the community to wait for answers to some of these questions that are really plaguing our neighborhoods and pressing problems. So we've identified these 5 here, and we identified another one on Monday about things that we want to make significant progress on and start reporting back to you as early as August on some of the answers to these questions. The first one, of course, is the partnerships, and again, we've already started that. That's been great. The next one is something that we're calling Project Reset. There are a number of programs or projects that have languished in the housing department for many, many years. We're going to ask for Ms. Marquez's help to review, round up all those projects, take a review of them, see which ones are viable, which ones are not viable, set some time frames for those projects, either bring them into compliance and get them on track, or wash them out. She did this in L.A. and kind of gathered up about $57 million in projects that had been allocated but unspent that became a new investment pool for her for new projects. I don't know that we can get $57 million, but it certainly would be a good start at looking how to find catalyst money for some of these important projects that we launch. One of the things that we've been talking with our CHOTOs about for several weeks, months now, is a new CHOTO strategy. They've been very helpful in pointing out for us things that are working well, things that are not working well, offering ideas about how we can strengthen those relationships. Unfortunately, we only have 8 CHOTOs that are working and functioning in Dallas right now, and that's just not sufficient. Several years ago, we had as many as 30 in a city that's the 9th largest city in the country, should have a more robust nonprofit and CHOTO community. So we need to find ways to build that capacity, strengthen those CHOTOs, and make sure that they're working and successful in Dallas neighborhoods. We've heard several times that our land banking strategy and our tax delinquent property strategy is simply not fast enough. It's not efficient enough. And it's not putting those lots back into productive use quickly enough. We had conversations with the attorneys at Linebarger, and I think Pam's here today, and they are at the table with us and ready to roll up their sleeves and help us retool our current strategy. So we're very encouraged by that. And then this money matrix idea. One of the criticisms of the housing department for a long time has been, where is this money and what money is available and where are these sources and how can I access the money? It's not been a transparent process. And so the idea of this is to make all that accessible and open so that people know and the council knows. I know I've heard frustration expressed on your parts as well about where does this money come from and how can I access it. So those are the types of things that we'll be doing. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time here on this workshop. Many of you have done these workshops before. What we'll do, Robin, if you'll go to the next slide, what we'll do is Pierre and I are going to come around. We're going to talk to each of you about neighborhoods and target neighborhoods. We're going to ask each of you to identify one, maybe just individually or maybe with an adjoining council member. and look for opportunities. We're going to have some great big maps. John Fragnesi is going to lead this event for us. We're going to do a mapping workshop. We're going to ask people to identify the assets in their communities, the liabilities in their communities, where there are potential catalyst projects, where we can build on, what issues need to be addressed. It'll be fun. It'll be very interactive. We're going to ask you to think about what neighborhoods you want to work on and think about what resource people in your neighborhoods that you would like to bring and help you, and what resource people that we need to have available. Code enforcement, the Crime Watch people, streets, all of those resources. I think Ms. Davis has a very good WIN model in her neighborhood that she has a monthly meeting, I think, that really looks at coordinated service delivery from all city departments and even outside agencies, the county health department, other partners that we'll need to really identify what's going on in these neighborhoods and how the city could make a strategic investment or offer a strategic approach to really start to solve these problems. So we'll be coming to you and asking you for that. Now, that's the beta test. When we're going to use you guys as guinea pigs, we'll get this kind of, we'll get this effort refined, and then we'll go out and we'll take this effort into the community in 5 different public workshops around town. And that'll be a lot of fun for the citizens. We think it'll be engaging, and we think we will learn a lot from that. Now, we can't do a hard copy map of every single neighborhood in the city. So what we've done is we are developing an online map-based tool for neighborhoods to do this kind of in online, what we're going to do in hard copy. This is a very, they've come a long way in GIS mapping. You used to have a degree in GIS to understand how to do one of these maps. Now, if you've got Google on your phone, you can do this, right? Because it's based with icons. We'll design a very interactive, fun kind of way that people could go online, draw a ring around their neighborhood, and start to identify their assets and their liabilities. They can post pictures, they can post videos, they can write notes to us. And it'll be GIS interactive, so once we collect all this information from neighborhoods, we can then start to analyze it with our GIS tools. So it's a very powerful, very robust tool, but it's also very friendly and easy to use. One of the things we hope to do is engage a lot of high school students, community college students, and college students. We want to have a youth initiative that's associated with this to get those people who are our future residents thinking about their neighborhoods. Kids, teenagers think about their neighborhoods very differently than adults do, and so we want to be able to engage that element as well. We had a great Fair Housing Symposium earlier this year, and we want to have another one in the fall to continue this dialogue with national caliber speakers about the state of the housing market and neighborhoods in Dallas. We were just meeting with the community development officers at the Federal Reserve Bank yesterday, and they've offered to host a symposium for us. We're very excited to have their partnership and have the opportunity to access those resources. When we do our neighborhood outreach, those five, we'll start off with a block party. The Meadows Foundation is hosting this over at their properties, so we want to have a like an old-fashioned ice cream kind of block party social. It'll be a lot of fun. We'll have our mapping tools out there. We'll start to engage people. We want to have a My Hometown video contest where teenagers, I mean, my 7-year-old now is making videos with her phone. So we're going to ask kids and teenagers to make videos about their neighborhoods. What do they like? What do they don't like? And post them on our website. We'll have a little competition. It'll be a lot of fun. We'll be able to engage the youth again one more time. And this is some information about the workshops. And in terms of costs of the plan, the HUD assistance, the value of that is $350,000. We're guessing at that. We think that's a pretty accurate guess. That's not something that we'll have to pay for. We have already had offers of foundation assistance. We haven't accepted any money yet, but we feel like we're going to have a lot of opportunities for people to participate in that. We think our consultant costs should run no more than $300,000, and those will be the contracts that will be on for your approval on June 25th. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. And just to remind you that Pierre and I will be setting up meetings with each of you individually.
Ms. Gates?
Thank you, Teresa, for...
Hold on. I got another list, Ms. Gates. Ms. Madrano will first. I'm sorry.
No, yeah. Before we go any further, I'd like to be the first one and counsel to congratulate you on your recent marriage last week.
I thank you very much.
San Diego. And
you.
So I saw the pictures on Facebook. It looked like a beautiful ceremony. Congratulations. Wish you the best. And you do. You have a beautiful family.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Gates, you next.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And thank you, Teresa, for a great presentation. So I'm thrilled that we're taking a look at the housing through a neighborhood approach. And, you know, and that you're willing to work with us. I mean, I know there's, you know, some neighborhoods in my district that, you know, we could take a stronger look at. And I'm thrilled to be able to work with you on those initiatives. Because I really believe, and I've been following the articles and the essays in the Dallas Morning News on why people consider their, you know, their neighborhood strong or what's good about their neighborhood. And I truly believe that's really kind of the foundation for having a strong Dallas is being able to build strong neighborhoods. So to be able to identify that and make sure that, you know, their housing needs are met, but also the community needs, and that we're going to be able to assess that and have really places that everybody can live, work, and play, and be proud and have ownership. And I think that's really important that the neighbors are kind of have that identity and be able to claim their neighborhood and their uniqueness and the specialness of their community. And I think that with this approach, we're going to be able to really kind of build that in our community. So thank you. Thank you for your hard work. I know it's you've been working very hard, and I think you're heading in the right direction. So, and whatever I can do to help you. So, thanks. And congratulations personally.
Ms. Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, as the housing chair, I want to thank staff for working with me on these ideas. I've been in housing since 1982. So I've been equipped with a lot of this information from the hard knocks of life. The first thing I want to do, Teresa, is thank all our sponsors, our partners. Thank you for letting them step up to the table. I believe what we're doing here is the right way to go. I want to thank my co-chair, Scott. Thank you for working with me. On this, I want to thank my housing colleagues. Thank you, guys. Each one of you for us coming together to try to come up with some ideals to make our whole city work when it comes to housing. One of the things that Teresa talked about and which I think is real important, the most important thing for me, is the meeting on the 26th where we will come together and identify areas in our own district and what makes them unique. Also, we also need to look at areas that have problems, and we need to identify those problems. I believe that no one should have to leave their neighborhood for a better quality of life. People should be able to stay in their neighborhood for a good quality of life. I believe it's the sustainable neighborhoods, and what is that? Making sure that you have all the necessary amenities in your neighborhood that you need to live there. So I'm hoping that's what that meeting will be about, or that workshop that we're trying to do is to look at everything, just lay everything out on the table, and what makes a good neighborhood. Also, I want us to include Association of Realtors as a part of that as well. I'd like for you guys to be a part of that meeting on the 26th, because as we talk about our rental property agreement, we need to also deal with some of these slumlords. We have good owners out here who rent properties. Then we have ones from the past who refuse to change. And I think that this brings down a neighborhood as well. So we can have them there as a part of the conversation with us, Teresa. I sure would appreciate that. As we go through this workshop, I'm hoping that each one of us, and if you don't have a neighborhood that have any concerns, then that's okay. But if you have an area in your district that requires some attention, then you need to be a part of that workshop. Am I right, Teresa?
And if I may, so we want to look at all neighborhoods. We want to look at all neighborhoods because all of our neighborhoods, even those that seemingly may not have problems, all of those neighborhoods are growing and aging.
Yeah, that's true.
And like in Ms. Gates' neighborhoods, those are hot neighborhoods right now, and they're experiencing a lot of transition and a lot of kind of tear downs and rebuilds, and that transition is disruptive to those families. Growth is always a good thing, but so even in those neighborhoods that we consider prosperous, there are things that need to be addressed. There are issues that we need to be aware of and be planning for down the road.
And in those neighborhoods as well, I think, Teresa, we also, we talked about at the housing retreat, that code needs to be a part of our conversation. The police department needs to be a part of our conversation. The rental agreement needs to be a part of our conversation. You can't build in inner city neighborhoods until we can deal with all the other issues that we're facing. I think that's one of the things that we need to talk about. And I hope when we talk to our consultant that he understands that some neighborhoods are going to be coming with different issues than other neighborhoods. The other thing, as we go through this workshop, I'm hoping that he will have pieces out there on the table, a variety of elements on the table, so that we can draw a perfect picture, a not-so-perfect picture, and pictures that we see today. So how do we transform that? So I'm hoping that happened as well. The other thing, the cost. What is the cost of making sustainable neighborhoods healthy again? What's that cost? And who will be the partners at the table to make sure it happens? So you take Mill City, for example. That might be one of my focus area of trying to bring all the right resources into an area. Now, there's an area I think we've done it right, Bear Street. I think we've done what's right on Bear. And so do we want to look at elements like that? And what was that cost and how long did it take us to get from beginning to end for a street or a neighborhood to kind of look like Bear Street? So with those elements, the other thing that I think we need to put into the cost is the timeline. How long will it take us if we just decided to focus on a particular, each council member, a particular neighborhood? What would be the time element of that? And then the last thing is matching the CDBG dollars, matching the HUD dollars, matching the 108 dollars, matching banking dollars, matching other housing dollars that's out there to help with what we're trying to do. And then the last thing for me is land. How do we deal with land bank? So if a Choto, for example, is trying to build and rebuild on infill lots, then can they get that land cheaper than what they're paying right now to build neighborhoods back up? Okay? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. 1 minute, Mr. Carraway.
You know, that's going to be impossible. If I could get some folks up to the microphone, and I need Carl Z and Bernadette and Housen, Lee McKinney, Teresa O'Donnell, Ryan Evans, and if I get you all coming to the microphone, let me up to the podium with Teresa. Let me read today's Dallas Morning News and the editorial: Bridging Dallas North South Gap, Reform Dallas Housing, City Hall Must Change Departments. If you're on the outside looking in at Dallas City Hall, you have almost no chance at understanding how
its housing department works. You can pore over old documents, council briefings, and spreadsheets all the while trying to add this up and subtract that. But you'll have little to show for your effort. It's still near impossible to figure out how and where millions of dollars in federal funds were spent to reconstruct a portion of Bear Street or build a new chicken restaurant that's Rudy's on Lancaster Avenue. What I want to ask you all, and I want to get this clarified once and for all, I want to talk about Rudy's and housing. And the story has, first of all, how much federal money does Rudy have? Come up to the microphone. Let's put all this on record.
Yeah, this is not true. Yeah.
There were no federal dollars invested in Rudolph Edwards' business.
Okay, so that is, there is no federal, Ryan, is that, I mean, AC, Ryan, everybody need to tell me, and I want the Dallas Morning News to be listening. There are no federal dollars into this chicken restaurant of Rudy's on Lancaster. Carolyn, please.
Okay. No, so there's no federal dollars in the restaurant. Ms. Kerwood, one of the issues with Lancaster is that there are many projects.
But hold on. I'm speaking specifically with Rudy's. I'm not talking about Serenity. I'm not talking about nothing else. I'm talking about Rudy's Chicken. Because here's the deal. Come on, Carl. I'm going to clear this up once and for all. The mayor and I have had conversations. We've had conversations. We've talked about it. But the morning news continued to write that Rudy's were given a grant and do not want to give the credit to this businessman for having put up his own property and cash. And it was said to me, counsel, that we made a mistake and that we were going to clear it up. But we were going to send back out the word to the morning news so that they could understand that this establishment did not receive a $900,000 grant. And it is impugning the character of this businessman that had $611,000 put up of his own property and his own land, plus he wrote a $63,000 check. Now that doesn't sound like a grant to me. If the man put up property of $611,000 and wrote a $63,000 check, and they continue to say that we gave him the chicken place. And they went so far as to call it the chicken shack. Now, all I want to do today, since it's in housing, and we're talking about housing, and they wrote it in the morning news in today's editorial that the chicken restaurant was given this federal money. Now, somebody need to explain to me. Now, you said that it didn't. I'm only strictly talking about Rudy's. And did he get any federal money? You said he didn't. Have we changed positions?
No, we have not changed positions.
Okay. So now, what I'm asking you, AC, as the city manager, let's clarify on behalf of the restaurant that there's no federal dollars that were given to the Rudy's Chicken restaurant on Lancaster. Now, there are other projects on Lancaster, granted, that have federal dollars that may evolve in and around the project, but it is unfair for this businessman to have to be maligned and not told the truth. So I would ask you all, today, Sean Williams, if you're listening, you all write a statement from City of Dallas, stating the fact, clarifying this, so that folks will not be misled about what this businessman did. He did step up to the plate. We did give him
some assistance. It was not federal money that we closed the gap, however, whatever we did have to do. So, but it is not that. And I want this cleared up, because now the way I was told by you all was that it was the way that it was placed on our agenda is what is that. Step up to the mic. You're shaking your head, Bernadette. Tell us through this microphone, what, how did this happen?
Certainly. In November 2012, everyone was briefed on the Lancaster corridor itself, and in particular Lancaster Keys project,
right,
to be phased in four phases.
Okay.
In December 2012, you all took action to appropriate about $3.4 million to begin wholesale acquisition of the entire almost two blocks of property.
Right.
And so that occurred very fast. Within that gauge, Rudy also was brought forward to you all. You all considered that. And in early 2013, you all awarded an amount of money equivalent to $890,000,
okay,
for the reestablishment of his business from the old location to the newer location. And with that, he was to exchange a number of parcels equivalent to about $548,000. In exchange for that assistance. So the net was approximately $350,000 to fill the gap.
Okay. And so of the $500,000-some of his property, he put a $63,000 check, cash check, on the table with that.
Correct.
That brought him to $611,000.
That's correct.
So to everybody listening, the man put up his $611,000 for the Rudy's chicken and not the chicken shack. Okay.
If I might add, Mr. Kerway,
okay,
the gap financing was provided through 2006 bond, general obligation bonds.
Okay, and that's not federal.
No, sir.
Okay, and today, in today's paper, it is saying federal again, and again they are maligning, and I would ask that we would clarify to them. So I want to go through this. Now let me talk about how. Hey, thank y'all so much. Let me just talk about housing real quick. And tell you all where my points are with housing. I do believe that we should, as relate to Housing Plus, we should have a concentration on ex-offenders and a program that will take some of these boarded houses, AC, and we establish some type of a program where some qualified ex-offenders can go in and take some of these boarded houses that are blighted in our community that we're having a tough time getting rid of, and maybe they can renovate the house if we could find a way to make that available to them while we're waiting and we're using demolition dollars and we're waiting and the community is having to have to deal with this blighted house in their community next door to their very houses that they live in. If indeed an ex-offender or a veteran, if there were some type of a program where you could take a house that's only worth $10,000 that we're going to have to spend $15,000 just to tear it down, that we've had code enforcement going by there every day that's been standing there for 10 years, so they've been putting these orange and green signs up, and we've been cutting the high weeds, well, we're still mounting the costs. I think that we should consider in Housing Plus a way to provide the tools, get with Home Depot, get with somebody that's going to give us the tools, and we lend out the necessary support, and we restore that house, and then it also helps us with the homeless as well. Mm-hmm. It takes people off the street. It gives us an opportunity to not have to send anybody by there cleaning the property. It keeps the community somewhat vibrant, and it puts a person, be it an ex-offender, a veteran, or someone, in that house. Now, to the lawyers, you all got to figure out, Warren, how we can do this. If indeed we need to change ordinances, if indeed we need to go through some legislation to try to legislate how we can. And Chief Brown, let me just throw you in it. If indeed it's a drug house that we can confiscate and we can automatically take and use that house to turn these people to work on that house so that that house can become livable, then we've done something that's significant in the neighborhood, and we've not just let it sit there and rot away. So I wanted to say that as it relates to ex-offenders and the veterans, and figure out a way how we can better deal with that in housing. The last thing I wanted to say, the ones and twos, and these are the things I said the other day. To do a house over on Ville Big and then to go and do a house over on Sunset and then to do a house over on Cleburne and to do a house here. We still, because there are more than 1,000 of these houses in just my district alone that are boarded and unlivable. So if we're going to build, we have to build as we did over on Pittman, Ms. Davis, off of Martin Luther King. You have to build a little community, okay? Because no one is going to want to come and build a house, and then the other part of the neighborhood does not match what they're building today. So what we're going to have to do is figure out a way to, when we knock down houses, when we have these little areas like the cul-de-sac on Pittman, that we can build 4, 5, or 6 houses and not do one here and do one there, and it's just like a little patch blanket. If we're going to build the communities, if we're going to do all this retail, and we're going to encourage quality retail and clean up the community and become responsible, then we're going to have a better plan. And the Chotos and the folks that we discussed this with in housing the other day somewhat all agreed. So thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Carraway. Mr. Cadet?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Ms. O'Donnell. On page 15, I think it is, you're talking about the money matrix. And do we currently have funds for this project? Are we currently funded in any way?
The Housing Department receives about $25 million a year in federal funding of one sort or another.
And that's $25 million we can get?
Yes, sir, and we hope to get more.
Oh, good.
We hope to, now the entitlement funds, the allocations are declining, but what seems to be ramping up are the opportunities to get these choice neighborhood grants, promise zone grants, and there's significant federal funds invested in those from a multitude, not just HUD, sometimes transportation dollars, sometimes healthcare dollars, but there's a significant amount of money to be had.
And then I think you were talking about getting partners to come in and help us, so... Do you have any idea where those partners will come from?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. Mm-hmm. On page 16, you talk about engaging the council with the pilot neighborhoods. Will those come directly from us?
Yes. We're going to come and talk to you, and we're going to give you some ideas for suggestions, but we want to hear from you, because you all know your neighborhoods better than we do, about which neighborhoods are struggling,
and
which ones need help, and what they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you've got on page 19 the web tool map, which I guess there's going to be a website. I didn't see any
yes,
on here.
Yes, we'll have a website, and we'll have this online mapping tool.
And you're going to have, and the public has access to that?
Yes.
So come on and put what they want down.
Yes, and we're working as hard as we can. We might have that, be able to launch that by June 26th. I'm looking at Pierre and hoping he doesn't pass out over there, but within a month, that website will be up and running.
You feel like you're going to get a lot of hits on that website?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is fun stuff.
That's what
young people
going.
Really enjoy this.
Will you keep each district up on what you're hearing
yes.
and what
mm-hmm.
you're
because
seeing
we've,
website.
Our contract with the mapping firm requires a seamless interface with our GIS system. So
oh,
we can
good.
Take all that information and we can start to compile it
yeah.
and slice it and dice it and analyze it and give us some real-time feedback with real data.
Good.
Not just anecdotal data, but we've done extensive mapping. And there are, like the Fed is going to do some mapping for
yeah.
us. The Children's Hospital is going to do some mapping for us. We've got a lot of partners already engaged that can help us. Children's Hospital already has address-specific rates of childhood obesity, diabetes, asthma. I mean, those are very powerful information tools. So when we're talking about PLUS, healthcare is going to be a big part of this PLUS.
Yes.
And how we can deploy resources with the hospitals, with the county, in terms of really addressing problems on the ground.
Yeah. Okay. And that's going to really help us too. Once you get that,
yes.
So we're going to know what we really need and want.
So what we'll be able to do is quantify
yeah.
what you already
exactly.
know,
exactly
what you already have a good
yeah.
strong intuition
yeah.
about, and what you're hearing from your neighbors.
Good. Then on 21, you talk about the neighborhood block party.
Right.
Will each district get a block party?
Mm-mm. No. No. We don't have funds for that.
Well, you
but
put
we,
maybe
we,
two or three together. And
yes, we're going to try to put two or three together. And they'll be fun.
Yeah.
We'll have neighborhoods come out. We'll teach them about these online tools. But we
yeah.
see it as a two-way information exchange. We'll learn from them,
yeah.
and we can talk to them about tools
yeah,
and potential
are
ideas.
Good. And it pulls your communities together.
Yes, they love it.
I think you're really
mm-hmm.
good.
Right.
Then you mentioned there would be five regional
workshops around
yeah.
town. And we're trying to align those with the service districts because,
yeah.
as you've heard, coordinated service delivery, code
yeah.
enforcement, the police department, streets, so we want to rely on those service districts so we can coordinate all the city and
okay.
internal resources.
And how will you notify everybody of all this?
We will ask your. We have our office has a pretty extensive database. Your offices have very extensive databases.
Yeah.
The strategic customer service. So we'll round up
yeah.
all those. We'll do mailers and we'll do online.
Yeah, I'd love to go to my website also with when and what and where and how.
We'll do a training workshop.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Madam Mayor.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Teresa, we talked a little bit about this the other day in housing, but we're hiring a lot of consultants for this
yes.
plan, and I was very impressed with Ms. Marcus, anxious to work with her, but I'm concerned that if we don't have some of this expertise in-house, we may need it, particularly this mapping consultant. I'm very disturbed to understand that our map department can't already do this.
They can. They can do this. What we're looking for is speed and time. Our mapping, our GIS and our CIS department have pages and pages of workload activities. We're looking for results within a month. This online mapping service is extremely affordable right now. I think the
okay.
consultant contract is $10,000. Is that right? Under $10,000. So we think in terms of the time value of money, we think it's a very good investment.
Well, except we set the schedule. So,
right.
You know, we need it in a hurry because we didn't start until now.
Right.
So I'm just saying for the future, if we need to continually evaluate whether consultant contracts are a good way to go and whether they're telling us something about the expertise that we need in-house at the city.
Yes, sir.
The other part of this, colleagues, the other day in housing, the thing that I enjoyed about this is we don't have any real control over the federal scheme for housing funding. It was primarily set up in the 60s and 70s, and it's based on data from northeastern cities that show that they don't have sufficient supply of affordable housing. That I believe to be untrue for Dallas. But it doesn't matter because the only way to get the federal funding is to subsidize supply. I think, you know, if I could wave my magic wand, we would have no supply subsidy whatsoever, and we would make it illegal to discriminate against somebody who's using a voucher, and then we would just fund the demand and let people go live where they want to live. So the thing that I enjoyed about the Housing Plus proposal from the other day is that element of letting people choose is somewhat reflected in this by looking at what neighborhoods want for themselves. And that neighborhood self-determination, I think, is a mantra that we all need to adopt for any kind of land use policies in Dallas. I think when you ask people who live there what's right for their neighborhood, you almost always get the right answer. So I'm looking forward to supporting this as the best that Dallas can do given the constraints it's under in terms of getting federal funding. And I appreciate the hard work on this. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Callahan.
Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Council Member Davis, I really want to thank you for your leadership in this area. I know you've worked on these projects a long time, 32 years, and I appreciate your capable leadership, too. You can see that as we go about these meetings. I look forward to working with us and Mrs. Marcus. Ms. Marcus, you know, we've seen her and met her a couple of times now, and she obviously has a great, very solid resume. I've also met and worked with Mr. Fragan Nacy, you know, in one of the studies out in the Pleasant Grove area in the last few years. Very capable, very intelligent man, very organized, and very high tech. So he gets a lot of audience feedback, you know, that he utilizes. So I'm looking forward to that. I think he's very dynamic in what he brings to the table. I think we have a good plan. I think it's a solid approach. It's multifaceted. And but as I mentioned yesterday at the housing meeting, and I'd like to reiterate some of those comments because I want to make sure that we look at a multilateral approach. It's not just about housing and putting people in bricks and mortar, but it's also trying to cure the effects of some urbanization, some slum, some blight, some neglect, a lot of those things, and it's real critical. And I like Ms. Davis also invite, you know, Peter and Romeo, you guys, to get involved with us. I think it's real critical for the National Association of Realtors and the local groups to get involved in that. And I've been, you know, active with you guys for a long time, going back to about 1979. So, but I want to make sure that we speed along this process, you know, of either demolitioning the houses that are just not capable of being rehabbed. You know, a lot of them can be. A lot of them can be, and I think we ought to utilize those, perhaps those that can be saved and rehab, maybe for the reentry prospects, the veterans. We've got a lot of people coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're in great need, and I think we absolutely owe it to them. We've promised them that we would take care of their every need, and we need to get about doing that, and we want Dallas to be a friendly place for those, because many of those kids, or I say kids, or your young people coming back home, you know, after serving, you know, responsibly, gallantly, you know, in the various wars that we've had. But we also have got to get this thing through the pipeline. There's a lot of homes that, you know, that need to be taken back. They haven't paid taxes. Some of them in our area have been sitting there 10 years. It's just no lie. There's no lie at all about that 10 years. Some are now ready for that pipeline, but understand that pipeline is growing. 500 or 600 of these homes that need to be sold. Some are vacant lots. Now, we've already gleaned those that can be used commercially or for city purposes or other, maybe DISD, whatnot. But so these are kind of the dregs of the pot, as I said yesterday. It's time to take these, get them through the system, make sure investors get them. Make sure that those that can be utilized in the land bank are used, and move that process along, not to mention the past due taxes, attorney fees, late fees, all of those things. There's a lot of money that's tied up in that area, mow land money that the city, we've gone about cleaning and mowing these problem properties for a long time. Now, we'd like to recover some of our investment. I notice AC that goes up seemingly every year, the MoClean budget, and it's never enough. It's just never enough. And we've had help enough from the National Guard, and maybe we need the U.S. Army and the Marines and the Navy. Get them all in here to help. But we sure have got to do some things about that. One thing I want to continue to drive home, and you've heard me say this more than once, but it needs to continue to happen. We need to go after more market rents. You know, the mayor talks about, you know, growing south, and you can't grow south if you have no disposable income. There's no way that Chili's and Starbucks and retail and all of those things, they're not going to chase rooftops that have no money. And it's debilitating for the community too. You know, we need to stratify our income. We need to make sure that there's more than just $15,000 and $20,000 a year household income. Now, a lot of those people are seniors, you know, that are on a fixed income Social Security check. Some are disability income. But we need to grow the income in southern Dallas, Pleasant Grove, South Dallas, Oak Cliff. We need to make sure that people are making $25,000, $35,000, $40,000 and up. You know, there's a lot of city employees that make $30,000-$40,000 a year, police and fire in that $40,000-$50,000 range. We want these people to be our neighbors. We want those people to buy houses, so we need to make sure that those people have those opportunities. And I think that will go a long way towards helping the mayor grow south. You know, they say build it, and we will come, you know. But if the money's not there, then we're going to get more of the same predatory type things that Jerry, I know, has been working to try to stop, the payday lenders and the title loans and all of those people that are just after the poor people, what little money they do have. Well, we don't want that kind of economy in my district in South Dallas anymore. We need to make sure there's more employment and career opportunities. And our people every morning, headlights going north. You know, where do you work, Frisco? Where do you work, Las Colinas? Where do you work? I work in Richardson, Plano. Enough. Come on. You know, we can bring jobs to our community. We have people that have the level of education that can take these beginning positions and mid-level positions right here in the mornings, right here in our local communities. And we need to also fix those social ills, those problems of blight and neglect that we've talked about. You know, it's been very well chronicled, you know, loose animals and panhandlers and vagrants, and we've got homeless, you know, people standing with really no place to go or nothing to do. We've got bandit signs, you know, selling anything from beauty aids to a house to a used car, or we buy gold and silver. You know, it's the street corner is not the marketplace. And we've got code issues, we've got loud parties, you know, that thank God, Chief, thank you for what you're doing to help us out there. And Chief Coleman, I want to throw out thank yous because we were really working to try to eliminate that. We also want to develop, you know, culture of cleanliness. You know, that's going to enable us to build the houses and do that sustainable type of building of those houses that we're looking for. We also want to knock out these hourly motels, you know. Not sure why they ever ended up there, but we don't want them. We don't want any of them anymore in our community. Smoke shops is becoming a big problem. They're popping up everywhere like wildfire, like weeds coming out of the ground. We're open 24/7. And, folks, all these things are havens for prostitution, eight-liners, you know, illegal drug use, illegal drinking, just all kinds, all hours of the night. And we want that to stop. So we've got a lot of work to do. So it doesn't help just to say thanks for the federal monies or, yeah, we've got a great housing policy, because we're not going to be successful unless we're able to resolve some of these critical issues that that really plague our community. And it's time to get started and build, a multifaceted plan. You know, housing is one ingredient. Economic development is one ingredient. But also the job component, you know, again, disposable incomes, you know, rising tides lift all boats, you know, that spillover effect that we're talking about. So it's time to get moving, Southern Dallas. It's time to grow South Dallas. It's time to grow Southeast Dallas. But we can only do that if we can eliminate some of these aggravations, because people are fed up. You know, I maybe made the mistake of giving them my personal cell phone number, but they do text and call me, and I've got a good relationship with many of them. But I want them to know that there's a stopgap. I'm waiting at the gate. I'm the gatekeeper. I'm going to be there for them. If it's 3:30 in the morning, so what? We're going to go after those people that are causing our quality of life to be diminished. It's real important, you know, that we work on these things and stop that, because I don't want the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, just so, you know, I'm just sick and tired of being in the city of Dallas because, and then this litany of reasons are put out there. You know, it's time to stop that kind of stuff, and we can do better. And this is Dallas, Texas, ninth largest city in the country. We have a great city, but we've got to eliminate these things that aggravate us, and then by doing so, once we have a better quality of life, then it's going to be good for everybody. And then those tax dollars will come up, and then we'll be able to pay for the things that we need to pay for. But we've got to build that income within the community, and that means that tax base is increased, and it means more sales tax, more property values being increased, and then we all win. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mayor, and congratulations to you, Teresa, and I guess my invitation got lost in the mail, but Sorry, I couldn't help that. Couple things. I'm really excited that you're taking over this task. Department, you know, the Dallas Morning News did say from an outsider looking in, it's hard to figure it out. Well, I've been here almost a year, and from an insider looking in, it's also difficult to figure out. So I'm glad that we're going to add some kind of data-driven components to it and really try to look at where is the need, what are the dollars that are available, what additional dollars could be utilized, and how can we use it in our city. I think part of the concept of fair housing means fair to all of our residents throughout the city and not having it concentrated in just certain components of the city. And the reason I bring that up is, you know, in my district, I've got five elementary schools where over 95% of the kids are on free lunch programs. This housing covers all parts of our city. There are pockets and there are areas and there are all things that need the help. So I really appreciate that we're going to take an approach where we're going to look at where's the need, what are the opportunities, and really take your approach, which I appreciate, is what can best serve those areas and those neighborhoods. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. And I think that's really a terrific approach. I'm very, very excited about that. So thank you very much for taking this on. I want to thank my colleagues, the chair and the vice chair of that committee, for really providing the leadership in that area as well. And I think we can really provide a good product for our citizens and just improve the quality of life of the city of Dallas. Thank you.
Thank you. One of the statistics I heard from Larry James yesterday was that in the Dallas area, I think it's the greater Dallas area, there is over $500 million of untapped food assistance. So when I think about those 95% schools, imagine just having $500 million more going into grocery stores just for food for these kids.